Philip Doddridge. Grace is a charming sound, harmonious to the ear. Heaven with the echo shall resound, and all the earth shall hear. It's really a church story of grace. It's a story of a church that's changed almost beyond recognition in 50 years, but set in the environment of a society and a culture that's changed even more. The name of the church is Grace, although it changed its name twice through its history. Come on to that. We began by preaching the free grace of God. We certainly needed much grace at times, and we hope that we model grace in the life of our what's now a very diverse body of believers, and through sharing what God has given us. And we've been blessed to give away many dear brothers and sisters who've walked with us for a while, then left to minister in places and fellowships across Ireland and around the world indeed. And we've often sought to share the facilities that God has given us with as many as that can use them for the kingdom. And John Newton puts it well, 'tis grace that's brought us safe thus far, and grace will lead us home. So to the birth of grace. 12 years of hard labour by Chris and Helen Robinson. How many of you knew Chris? Good number, yeah. In open air preaching, street evangelism, and door to door, starting from the late 1950s. By the way, I'm really indebted to David Ellis for this early history of grace. As some of you know David, when I was in contact with him a few weeks ago. Anyway, the late 1950s, sometimes, as you will know, some of you, in those days, the workers suffered physical as well as verbal abuse. Indeed, on one occasion, Chris and his fellow workers had to be rescued from an escorting in County Wexford after some clerical incitement resulted in attempts to attack them. Anyway, 12 years of labour, tough, hard, difficult. About half a dozen folks converted to Christ. From a Catholic background, that often involved intervention from the priest, family hostility, and the new babes met regularly for Bible study at Chris and Helen's home in Renola. And as David Ellis remarked, that was before anyone had heard of the Alpha Course or Christianity Explored. Chris was engaged in one-to-one Bible study with each one as they came to Christ. And up until that time, church planting wasn't on anybody's agenda. Chris and Helen were members of Phibsborough Baptist Church, and he endeavoured to integrate the converts into the church. But the fact is that none of these converts was familiar with what was, frankly, the West Brit culture of evangelical Protestantism at the time. And that kind of ethos was really quite foreign to those who couldn't grasp, as was expected of them, that they should become Protestant. It was difficult with the existing churches. And the only alternative was to plant a new church. And David Ellis had been studying at the college in Belfast Bible College, and Chris invited him to come back to Dublin to start a new church in the city. And that didn't go down well with the leadership of the Irish Baptist Mission. And the matter was raised at the 68th Assembly. Anybody here in the 1968 Assembly? Right. Well, you'll recall that Chris was dismissed from the mission on that occasion. But there were two men, James Byers and Herbert Carson, were firmly resolved to get behind the new venture, and they, along with many loyal friends and the Lord's gracious providence, supported the work wholeheartedly. It was decided to register the Protestant Hall in Northumberland Road. There's more, it gets worse, I'll tell you later. On Sunday morning. So a small notice board was produced and displayed in front of the hall, indicating, first name, Northumberland Road Baptist Church. Sunday services, 10:30 a.m, Bible study, 10:30 Bible study, 11 o'clock morning worship. It's played the first time on the 28th of May, 1968. Alright, let's talk about the early years of the church. Reaching out to the gospel of the church was intense. We had meetings twice weekly. And David Ellis recalls that these were remarkable times. On Fridays, the Legion of Mary would pick up the meetings and heckle the preachers. And the approach wasn't one of being a church service out of doors. It was typically the case in those days, apparently. It was rather to provoke reflection, engage in debate. For example, one person was on the box speaking. Others would mingle with the crowd. Sometimes the crowds apparently were so big they'd be stopping the traffic. And if a person showed interest, they'd be invited for coffee in a nearby cafe and contact would be established. Sometimes things would get out of hand and get a bit physical. Preachers could receive a thumping, and David recalls that on at least one occasion he observed a knife drawn and Chris Robinson being stabbed. And at the same time as that was going on, there are also lectures organised in neutral surroundings like hotels or the mansion house, advertising. For example, in June 69, there was a lecture in the Regent Hotel entitled Can We Be One? By Chris Robinson. Those of you who remember Chris with the smile at that title. And on the 12th of January, Herbert Carson, 71, Herbert Carson lectured on Christian politics. January 71, Christian politics. Think back to those days, 1971, in the Four Courts Hotel. And at such meetings, an invitation was given to a follow-up meeting at the church premises. And even these lectures weren't without their problems. On one occasion, a hotel in Western Rome had been booked for a lecture, initially agreed by the management. However, the Legion of Mary got wind of it in advance and managed to persuade the management to revoke the booking. So opposition was never far away. And then the third arm of the work was Herbert Carson debating in seminaries, taking on Catholic theologians on such issues as baptism. And the vision of the church in those days, very straightforward, to reach out to Dublin by all legitimate means, and secondly, to have a missionary vision. The constitution was drafted with a lot of help from Herbert, and a particular doctrinal feature of the church at that time were doctrines of grace, the five solas of the Reformation, which was unusual in the Dublin context in those days. So even though the church, and it has to be admitted, that for many churches in Dublin, grace seemed like an odd church. And often didn't meet with their approval, to be honest. But growth was steady and really felt like a family when they were involved. There were away weekends, special outings. David Ellis recalled, we loved being together and there was a real sense of mutual commitment to one another. And it also should be mentioned that as the church became constituted, admission to the union as it then was granted and the past put behind. Baptisms were in the sea, Killiney Beach, Sandy Cove Harbour, sometimes pretty cold weather, but they were always joyous occasions. And between 68 and 72, the church grew from about half a dozen members to between 40 and 50. Then in 71, the church relocated from Northumberland Road to Brunswick Hall in Pierce Street, which was to become its permanent home, and the fellowship was renamed Grace Baptist Church. Now, Brunswick Hall itself, the building, was erected in the 1830s. Interesting history, actually, the hall. It was erected by an Anglican clergyman who was on the point of leaving the Church of Ireland and joining with the Plymouth Brethren, associated with J.N. Darby, a movement which, those of you who have historical bent in mind will recall, started in Angel Street in Dublin in the 1820s. So the early history of the hall is unclear, but we do know that after the 1859 revival, it was associated with the Brethren Assembly at Merrion Hall. And then it was later leased to a Presbyterian mission that was founded, a Dublin mission, and it leased the property from what was then the Brunswick Trust, probably in the 1880s. And the work was mainly a Presbyterian work, indeed a Reformed Presbyterian work latterly. But by the 1960s, the work had declined, and it was made available to Grace as a meeting place. So I kind of thought about this, and I thought, well, the building to which the church moved had Anglican, Brethren, Presbyterian, and Baptist associations at the time. And the stones, had they been able to speak, might have struck horror into the hearts of each of the occupants in turn as they related the errors of the previous resident. However, looking at it from another perspective, perhaps we can say that the gospel that went out in many different ways was preached faithfully throughout. In 77, the church bought the premises from the Brunswick Trust at a generously discounted price. Let me just show you a couple of pictures of Great Brunswick Street as it then was in the earlier period. It's 1915. See the entrance to Grace just right in there. And this building here, which is now part of the hotel, is the main British Army recruiting office in Dublin. That's 1915. And there's the Army Recruiting Office. That's 1960. Easter week. No Army Recruiting Office there to be seen. And that is the condition of the building as we entered it in 71, 72, 73. This was condemned as unsafe by the City Council. That's been knocked down in the start. What was his name, George?
Mr. Godkin,
that's right. And that's the front of the call, right? We'll be back in slightly. So, as I say, the premises were not salubrious. One main hall, the cottage was a doubtful safety standards, containing a kitchen of sorts, a ladies' toilet, and two small meeting rooms. An outside latrine for the men, and a derelict building on the front of the site, as you see there, deemed dangerous. And Sunday mornings in those early days of Grace are associated in the minds of many of us with floors so dusty that no child could be safely deposited upon them. Super Sur heaters were placed under the suspended light fittings, cause them to kind of sway hypnotically. And later, when the Super Surs were unable to heat the building sufficiently, an industrial space heater, which when switched on, produced a noise reminiscent of an aircraft taxiing. And the same Super Sur heaters, when used in the confines of the renowned sloping floor upper room of the cottage, when the midweek meeting was held, had a distinctly soporific effect on certain members of the congregation. So the 1970s was really a period of rapid growth. The pattern of church life established by the founding fathers continued through much of the 70s, though at a less frenetic pace than earlier. Sunday morning was a traditional hymn sandwich using Grace hymns. Anyone remember Grace hymns?
Yeah, not.
Good. The crisp preaching. What happened to those hymns? What was singing? It's a shame. Crisp preaching and Helen often on a kind of pretty honky-tonk piano. Evening service was similar. Monday night beginners Bible study led by Chris. Wednesday midweek prayer meeting, Bible study. And once a month on a Sunday afternoon, an open air meeting on the corner of Stevens Green. And there was an annual church weekend, which after a number of locations settled at the YWCA in Greystones, where it became a fixture for more than 20 years. And there was much fun and some good Bible teaching through the years. From the mid to the late 70s, the church experienced a further period of rapid growth, fueled largely by conversions of inner city residents of Dublin and also students who favoured the church's central location. A group of young people from the inner city were converted and produced a dynamic outreach outlook, as well as introducing some contemporary worship music. There was a young couple, Pat and Kaz Brown, who were living in very difficult circumstances with a small child. They were contacted through the OIM ship, Logos, and their impact, their testimony had a deep impact on their family. Pat's mother was converted, Anne Brown, and she went on, and many other members of the family also. Anne Brown became a faithful member of the church until her death, and his life and testimony filled the church to overflowing at a memorial service a few years ago. A real mother in Israel. Yes, please. So, as we've noted, most of the converts in the earlier years were from a Catholic background. And the church was formed at a time of political and social convulsion in Ireland. And although by the early 70s the church was within the fold, as it were, of the Baptist Union, as it then was, Grace still found itself at the centre of controversy from time to time. Thank you very much. See, the thing was, the church was characterised by a congregation and a leadership that was probably largely of a Republican bent, and you recall those days, very polarised political views. The proposal that the annual assembly of the Union send greetings to the President of Ireland as well as to Queen Elizabeth was not well received. Classic Grace move. Grace was also characterised by informal dress at a time when suit and tie were considered de rigueur in most churches. More than one visiting president of the Baptist Union felt obliged to hastily exchange his jacket for a jumper on preaching at Grace. Looking back, it seems to some of us that this distinct and rather radical identity which the church carved out led to an ungodly pride, a feeling that we were a cut above others, holier than thou. Perhaps the rather rough and ready premises and facilities, number of meetings that we attended, the measure that is, and the open air and the door work that many engaged in, together with some of the dramatic testimonies, made us feel in some distorted way superior to others. However, it wasn't long before our pride was shattered by dissension among the leadership and eventually a rupture between the founding pastor, Chris Robinson, and the congregation. This was a time, I have to say, of great wounding and dishonouring to the Lord. The rights and wrongs are known to God, but there cannot be any one of us who would not say with hindsight that we were without sin in this matter. And in the end, it was the gracious intervention of a brother from outside the church that was instrumental in bringing the matter to a close. Though wounds are slow to heal and often leave scars, which, though they can be powerful instruments in our sanctification, are nonetheless painful reminders that we could have done far better. Okay, let's move on to the 1980s rebuilding. So the lesson of history, historians, to some extent I think the lesson of history is the pendulum swings inexorably from one side to the other in matters of governance and style in church life as we recover from perceived excesses in one direction or another. Thus it was that Grace was without a pastor for some time after Chris's departure, and the view that plurality of eldership is the basis of church government became firmly rooted in the minds of leaders of the church. Indeed, it's still our view, and Grace being, as usual, unable or perhaps unwilling just to keep its counsel, tried to educate the Union into the truth so wonderfully discovered, and elected to eliminate the listing of pastor from his entry in the yearbook of the Union. Needless to say, the Union was unimpressed, and eventually the compromise was reached that the entry pastor would be labelled vacant. The church had two elders throughout that period, George Shearer and Fred Swarbrick, Fred being a full-time evangelist, and they were later joined by myself. And then in July 85, David Ellis came back from France, rejoined the eldership, and with the eye of an outsider, David helpfully recalls that of this time, the church had radically changed by then and rejected the position of a full-time pastor. Many had been influenced by the writings of John Zenz in his magazine, Searching Together. David goes on, I had the conviction of the nature of my calling by God, and though I was happy to work for the setup that was, felt strongly, should the Lord open up the way for me to exercise my ministry as I believe he'd ordained me to do, I would move on. That opportunity came 2 years later, when David accepted the call to be pastor of Cookfield Baptist Church in England. And the departure in 87 was very amicable, in his own words, without any sense of aggrievement, and a significant number of church members travelled to Cookfield for induction. During this time in the 80s, youth outreach became a feature of the church, and there were regular coffee bars on a Sunday evening with a ministry to quite troubled, really, young people. Sadly, there was little fruit, I think, in the end. It's fair to say, George, from that work. The most notable event being the window-smashing exploits of a young man who notched up 17 panes in one evening. Indeed, our reputation for welcoming attractive colourful appearances, including such characters as Pablo and Bonk, both of whom sadly ended up dying untimely and tragic deaths. How would you sum up the 80s? Well, maybe a period when the church licked its wounds, I suppose, from the bruising that had gone before, dealt with some tricky pastoral issues, and sought to mend relationships and find a new way forward. The church building became rather a metaphor for this, as the back of the roofs and windows certainly needed a lot of patching up from time to time. The 1990s, seeds of change. So in 1990, the church appointed Jacob Reynolds as full-time worker. Jacob was a convert from Catholicism, hailed from Drogheda in County Louth, and had spent more than 10 years studying and working in Canada. And his arrival was made possible in part by the generous donation of a manse by a then member of the church. And Jacob was joined in 95 by another full-time worker, Billy Matthews. Recalling his arrival in Grace in 1990, Jacob says, quote, I sensed that the church was rather battered and beaten by its earlier experiences and saw my role as encouraging and building up the fellowship. Size of the congregation was pretty steady during this period, though with more families possibly than before. And the rehousing of inner city residents to the suburbs, together with the attraction to the church from those further afield, meant that the church family at this point was becoming rather more scattered, and at that time home-based midweek study groups were introduced. I suppose with the benefit of hindsight, one could say that this period was one where we saw more of a focus on the development of home groups as a vehicle of ministry and pastoral care. And during this decade, the name of the church changed again from Grace Baptist Church to Grace Bible Fellowship. The change was rooted in a desire not to put any stumbling block in the way of the gospel. Baptist was not a good tagline, certainly in the South, for a church in this period, being associated in the minds of most either with very politically right-wing fundamentalists in the US or errant US presidents. Bible seemed more appropriate and relevant. Church denoted the building in the minds of most of the fellowship was more expressive. The change provoked another fight with the Baptist Union, of course, and near expulsion, but some timely intervention from friends in the Union saved us from disaster, and we lived to fight another day. During this period, two arson attacks on the church were made by a disgruntled client of an occupant of the premises, JobCare, and I'll talk about that a bit more later on. As well as destroying part of the building, the fire also robbed us of our church records, which was a shame. However, like Joseph, we can say that though our friend with the matchbox meant it for evil, God meant it for good. And as a result of the insurance monies and other fundraising, the church was able to demolish the old cottage, condemned at this stage as unsafe anyway, and build an extension to the main hall to provide a kitchen and toilets in the first instance, and after the second attack, additional meeting rooms upstairs. looking, it's very funny actually, the guy phoned the fire, you know, typical arsonist, phones the fire brigade after he sets the building on fire. And then a few weeks later, guards call him in and they said, yeah, I did it, I'm confessing it. I said, well, we weren't calling you in for that at all, it's something else you wanted to talk about. Since you confessed it, that's fine. But looking back, we can see how this building development actually made possible the growth in ministry which followed. And that brings us to the fourth period of Grace's history, the 21st century, which I've entitled Looking Outward, Modelling Grace. In 1998, Jacob Reynolds left to form found the Leadership Institute, which I'll tell you about in a minute, and Pat Mullen, also a convert from Catholic background, also from Drogheda, joined the team and remains with us until this day, celebrating 20 years of ministry in Grace. So the last 20 years, I suppose, has been characterised by an influx of believers from overseas, which meant we've got incredible ethnic diversity in the congregation and minority congregations meeting in the same building. Increased use of the church premises by other Christian ministries, church plants, and heightened missionary involvement. So diversity on a Sunday morning. When the Celtic Tiger began to roar in the 1990s, its call attracted numerous immigrants, amongst whom were Christians from many different parts of the world. Right now, probably for at least a third of our congregation, I haven't done that scientifically, that's my kind of gut feeling, English is not their mother tongue. Indeed, in the last 25 years, we've had more nationalities and ethnicities than I can remember. I wish we'd documented them more exhaustively. I think it's getting on for 40 different nationalities. And I won't list them all because it takes too much time. Well, for instance, we've had deacons from Romania, Singapore and Zambia. And we've had worship team members from Ukraine, Romania, India, the USA and Lithuania. We've experienced unity and diversity in a wonderful way. It is indeed a foretaste of heaven, praise the Lord. At the same time, our Irish members and adherents have been steady or even declining in numbers at times. And the Lord has brought our brothers and sisters from overseas, I believe at least in part, to support and encourage us for what are increasingly lean times for the gospel in Ireland. We've learned much from them. The Irish way is not always the best way. And then the establishment of ethnic congregations. At least four ethnic congregations have worshipped in our building and three remain there. First was the Chinese Christian Fellowship, formed in the early 80s, which met for about 10 years, I think, on our premises before they moved to their own accommodation. And there was also an active work in that period of teaching Cantonese to children of Chinese who settled in Ireland and English to their parents. And the Chinese work continues to prosper. Next was the Romanian Baptist Church. And a trickle of Romanians had begun to enter the country illegally before Romania joined the EU. These were largely Baptists from Transylvania, where at that time the influence of the Orthodox Church made it difficult to be a believer, and in particular a Baptist. They were therefore asylum seekers. And then when Romania joined the EU, the trickle turned into a flood of immigrant Romanians working in hospitality, construction, and the church benefited, and soon there was a desire for a Romanian congregation, which began to meet in the evening. After some years, they appointed a pastor, Narcis Nikita, who's partly supported by Grace, as well as the Romanian congregation. Then there was the Lithuanians, who, whilst not part of Grace from the start, asked for somewhere to meet and took the afternoon slot. The Romanians took an evening slot. And then a smaller group of Russians in the minor halls, also in the afternoon. As the years went by, we saw the need to draw closer, and that's now happened through a joint service which we hold every 2 months and joint youth work every other Friday night. As the second generation of immigrants grow up with English as their first language, there's been a natural coming together of the congregations, but still with a recognition that for the first generation and new migrants, there's still a need to worship in their own culture and language. So that's the ethnicity issue. And then the church premises has been used extensively by other ministries. As I said, in the 1990s, there was the Leadership Institute, founded by the former pastor Jacob Reynolds in 98. This joined with the Irish Baptist College, the Irish Bible College in 2000 to become the Irish Bible Institute, the IBI. And that finally outgrew the rooms we were able to give to it, and is now well established in Foley Street in central Dublin. The other occupant was an organisation called JobCare, a Christian charity which focuses on the reintegration of long-term unemployed and ex-offenders into the workforce. It's been using Grace premises now for 25 years, and at any one time there could be up to 100 people on the premises coming to use the resources to look for jobs or whatever, or on various JobCare programmes. So in the 90s and onwards, between the church, the IBI, and job care, the building was extremely intensively used. All week, all day, and in the evenings. And we also benefited hugely from the care and maintenance of the building provided by job care staff and participants. Church plants. Well, Grace has been involved in a number of church plants. The first was in the Dublin West community church in Blanchardstown. We gave two families to that, together with what was then Fellowship Bible Church. That was a joint church plant, and that continues to thrive. We're now considering the possibility of a second church plant in the North City area, jointly with Jamestown Road Baptist Church. And the Romanian congregation are also engaged in the church plant, and the Romanians living in, now get this, Portadown. It's true. And they've begun to hold regular meetings in the town with 30 to 40 people in attendance, supported by a number travelling each week from Dublin. It's life. You couldn't write the script, could you? Just couldn't write the script. And if you know, they have a problem with somewhere to meet, by the way. If you know somewhere that might be able to accommodate them in Portadown, talk to me afterwards. Missions. So David and Barbara Ellis were the first mission couple sent out in 72, 14 years in France, preaching, pastoring, church planting. Kirk and Madeline Joyce, who also worshipped in Grace, began evangelism in County Louth in the 80s and subsequently in the west of Ireland, where they currently are. Kieran and June Loughran attended Grace in the 90s, soon came to Christ through the ministry of the church. After training at Dallas Theological Seminary, the Loughrans began a church plant at Trim in County Meath in the early 2000s, and that church is now well established. My wife Sandra and myself joined Wycliffe Bible Translators in 1999, and we went to Cameroon, West Africa, for Bible translation and local literacy work. We've been based in Dublin since 2008 because of family issues, but we continue to support that work with regular trips. And arising from the church's involvement in Bible translation in Cameroon, a charity called Water for Cameroon was formed by church member Mick Toulon in 2007, and he's travelled regularly. I think he's on his 28th trip now to Cameroon, developing this ministry. Some 60 wells have been dug and clean water programmes undertaken. And arising in turn from that Water for Cameroon work, further initiative Cameroon Medical now provides financial assistance for needy cases, particularly women and children, whose requirements come to light in the world of crisis and work in the country. And finally, through the contacts of our former Sierra Leonean deacon, the church sponsors education of orphan children in Sierra Leone. Now, let me talk about the building and then just do some concluding remarks. That was the building in 1973, and that was the famous alleyway that led into the church. And that was in 2009, with the car park at the front, the little new addition in front of the main hall. And that was it in 2014 after the double mission had redeveloped their site next door. In 2006, we were offered a deal by the hotel next door. Sell your airspace for bedrooms and we'll give you a new church. It didn't work out, and how blessed we were that it didn't. But a slump in 2008, I'm sure we'd be faced with just a hole in the ground. God is good. The opportunity came around in 2015, and this time we did the deal. God willing, we'll move in next month, and hopefully it will look a bit like that. That's an odd impression, but if it looked like that, hopefully the next 4 months, it's almost done. It'll give us greatly enhanced facilities, which we're looking forward to sharing with all our congregations, job care, and anyone else who wants to use it for the gospel. We didn't go looking for a new building. Someone just offered to give it to us. I guess that's grace. So let me conclude. Congregation at Grace, I'll get a hold of this, started life in a building occupied by the Dublin and Wicklow Orange Lodge. It was perhaps an inauspicious beginning for a church whose vision was to win the lost in a monolithic Catholic city. It then moved to a building called Brunswick Hall on Pierce Street. Nearly all the congregation at that time could have told you who Padraic Pierce was. Few, mercifully, would have made the connection from Brunswick to the pre-1921 street name of Great Brunswick Street after the House of Brunswick, who took the British throne in 1714. A poll of our present congregation might show up to half not really knowing who the Orange Order are, maybe two-thirds not knowing who Padraic Pierce was, and as for Brunswick, with the trust wound up and the old building demolished, the name is finally consigned to history. You see, the Ireland of 2018 is almost unrecognisable to those of us who can remember back to 1968. Utterly changed, and nowhere more so than Dublin. Less than two-thirds of people now living in Dublin were born there. And every fourth person was born outside the state altogether. With the power of the Catholic Church spent, just 56% of those aged 20 to 34 in Dublin City profess themselves to be of this persuasion, while 33% say they have no religion at all. Right now, challenge of the gospel is to reach those who have been duped by militant atheism and the consumer society and are simply amusing themselves to death. It's not much different in Dublin than it is in London or Paris. That's how much we've changed. Our new building will have over its front door Jesus' words from Luke's gospel: heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. We want to be a witness for the one who declared, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," in an increasingly God-denying and confused society. For that, we will need, as we've always needed, much grace. Thank you.